Shalom, Hadav Arnix.
Welcome to our next session in the 12 Minor Prophets. We are in the book of Zechariah. This is session number 46. As we move through Ariel's exegetical outline notes in the Minor Prophets developed by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. And remember, you can pick up your copy of the Zechariah class notes from the website, and you can also pick up the Zechariah handouts that I've given to previous classes from the website as well. All right, time for some review. What did we see last session? Last session, we looked at verse 9, chapter 9, verse 9, dealing with the first coming. And then we jumped to the second coming in chapter 9, verse 10. And that gave me the opportunity to share with you the four types of messianic prophecy. There are four types of messianic prophecy. The first type is first coming prophecy. These prophecies deal with first coming events only and exclusively. Then there's second coming prophecy, and as the name implies, these prophecies deal with the second coming exclusively. Then there's the blend prophecies. The blend prophecies combines two comings of the Messiah in one picture, often with no hint at all that there's thousands of years between the two verses, between the two prophecies, between the two comings. And then there's the complete career prophecies that cover the first coming, the interval between them, and the second coming. So what we have here in Zechariah 9, 9, and 10 is a blend prophecy, combines the two comings of Messiah into one picture. First coming in verse 9, second coming in verse 10, with no hint that thousands of years exist between the two verses. In Zechariah 9, 10, we also read that when the kingdom comes, when Messiah sets up his dominion, his dominion will be from sea to sea. And we were given the borders of the promised land in a generic form, from the sea to sea, from the Mediterranean Sea to the Red Sea, and then from the river, so now we go north to the Euphrates River, and from the river, the Euphrates River, to the ends of the earth. So the western arm of the Fertile Crescent, and is not the limitation of the Messianic Kingdom. The Messianic Kingdom will be ruled by Yeshua on a worldwide basis. The territory that we'll know, that we call the Promised Land, that will be the capital country. Israel will be the capital country of the planet. But the Messiah's rule will be worldwide. The rabbis could not put together the verse 9 and verse 10, the suffering Messiah and the triumphant Messiah. In fact, they couldn't put this together, the idea together, in a lot of Messianic prophecies. So the rabbis developed the two Messiah theory. Under the two Messiah theory, you can study in more detail in the Messiah text by Raphael Patai, available on Amazon.com. I would recommend buying the Messiah text by Raphael Patai. Anyway, the two Messiah theory concerns two Messiahs. One, the suffering Messiah, and two, the triumphant Messiah. Two different people. The suffering Messiah is Messiah, son of Joseph, and the triumphant Messiah is Messiah, son of David. So we have Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. So this is the two Messiah theory, and with all the information we talked about last session. And I also reminded you that the rabbis often cover up the suffering Messiah material. And they say things like this: Jesus is not the Messiah because he didn't fulfill the prophecies. And of course, they point to the second coming prophecies. And we will agree, yes, he did not fulfill those prophecies, but he will. But he will. He hasn't fulfilled them yet. The rabbis also say things like this from the Rabbinical Council of America. The resolution approved in June 1996 by the RCA, which represents about 1,000 centrist Orthodox rabbis, said, "There is not and has never been a place in Judaism for the belief that Mashiach ben David, Messiah son of David, will begin his messianic mission only to experience death, burial, and resurrection before completing it." Well, it may not be in rabbinic Judaism, but it sure is in the Bible. So you have to bring out the suffering Messiah side of the coin and show your Jewish friend that there is a suffering Messiah. Now, what's the New Testament solution to the paradox? Not two Messiahs, but two Advents. Two comings of Messiah. The suffering Messiah is Yeshua of Nazareth at his first coming. The triumphant Messiah is Yeshua of Nazareth at his second coming. Then from verse 10, we move back to the near future with verses 11 through 13. There we learned a little bit about the Abrahamic covenant, when God signed and sealed the Abrahamic covenant. It was done in the fashion of the day, sacrificing an animal or animals, placing their cutting them in two and placing them side by side, creating a passageway between them. And the signers and sealers of the covenant passed between the animals, and they were saying, in effect, may what happened to these animals happen to me if I don't fulfill my end of this covenant. And here we see a picture of Abraham protecting the animal carcasses that he has sacrificed from the birds of prey. He didn't want this covenant defiled in any way. But he was put into a deep sleep. And so who passed through the covenant pieces? Well, God himself did. God alone did, in the form of two forms of the Shekinah, the blazing torch and the smoking firepot. This makes the Abrahamic covenant unilateral, dependent only upon God, because Abraham was in a deep sleep. He did not walk between the pieces. So the obligation lies upon God alone. So it is unilateral and it is eternal. Why? Because God is eternal. He is the one that will see that it gets fulfilled. Then we move from the near future to the section of Scripture that's constructed in such a way that the tribulation, the second coming, and the kingdom are all very, very tightly interwoven. And so I considered it one section of Scripture, 9:14 to 10:12. There we saw that God was portrayed as the good shepherd protecting his sheep, protecting Israel. And Israel was portrayed as God's treasured possession, as Deuteronomy 26:18 very pointedly states. We also learn that two major areas will see the return of Jewish people to the land, Assyria and Egypt. Now here are the borders of the Promised Land, as I understand them. And the section of Scripture said that the Jewish people will live in Gilead and in Lebanon. So we will come from Egypt to populate the land and from Assyria to populate the land. Why there will be large assemblies of Jewish people in Assyria and Egypt during the tribulation, I do not know. Scripture doesn't say, and we'll have to see how this all works out. But there will be large populations of people, Jewish people, in Assyria and Egypt to come and settle the land. And we also learned that the land would be entirely populated by Jewish people. And that's supported by Ezekiel 48, verses 1 through 29, which states that every tribe will have a swath of land from east to west, or west to east, whichever you want to say, from north to south, filling the promised land with Jewish people. So we start with Dan, the northernmost tribe, then Asher, then Naphtali, then Manasseh, then Ephraim, Reuben, Judah, then comes the millennial Mount Zion, and then the smaller tribes. These northern tribes apparently will be a lot bigger. The smaller tribes would be Benjamin, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun, and Gad. So Israel will fill the entire promised land during the Messianic kingdom. So from the tribulation period, we now jump back to the first coming in chapter 11, verses 1 through 14. And that's where we pick it up today, with the rejection of the true shepherd in chapter 11, verses 1 through 17. So we're jumping back to a very, very important point, and there's going to be a total and drastic change in tone and subject matter right now. Now, commentators are undecided on how to take verses 1 through 3 in a literal or a figurative sense, but I think the figurative view fits best for this. So let's start with verses 1 and the first part of verse 2. Here, Lebanon is mentioned. But it's not the territory of Lebanon. Open your doors, O Lebanon, that fire may feed on your cedars. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen, because the glorious trees have been destroyed. Well, notice, a country doesn't have literal doors like that. So this is probably a figurative, should be figuratively interpreted, and, you know, within symbolic doors. And in Jewish thinking, this is a figurative reference to the temple. This verse was interpreted as a prediction of destruction. The temple was inviting the invaders to enter and destroy. And that's found in Yomah 39b. Our rabbis taught during the last 40 years before the destruction of the temple. 40 years. Subtract 40 years from 70 AD, and you come to 30 AD, which is the year in which Yeshua was sacrificed, was crucified. So from the last 40 years, from the time Yeshua was crucified until the destruction of the temple, the lot for the Lord did not come up in the right hand, nor did the crimson-colored strap become white. And those are references to the Yom Kippur services, the scapegoat services. Nor did the westernmost light shine. That's a reference to the menorah inside the temple. And the doors of the Heikal, the doors of the temple, would open by themselves until Yochanan ben Zakkai rebuked them, saying, Heikal, Heikal, temple, temple, why wilt thou be the alarmer thyself? I know that about thee, that thou wilt be destroyed, for, and here's our man, Zechariah ben Iddo, has already prophesied concerning thee. And here's Zechariah 11:1. Open thy doors, O Lebanon, O temple, that the fire may devour your cedars. So, why is it called Lebanon? Why is the temple called Lebanon? Well, the temple was adorned with cedar from Lebanon. And that's brought out in 1 Kings 5, 5 and 6. Now, Solomon is speaking here. Behold, I intend to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to David my father, saying, your son, whom I will set in your throne, in your place, he will build the house, the temple, for my name. Now, therefore, command that they cut for me cedars from Lebanon. And so that's why the temple was called Lebanon, because of the much beautiful cedar work that adorned it. So there's going to be a destruction of the land. The focus, however, will be on the temple. The land will be devastated. The focus will be on the temple. Next, Bashan is mentioned in verse 2. Wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the impenetrable forest has come down. So this would be a figurative reference to the priesthood, the spiritual leadership. They're mourning the temple's destruction. In verse 3, we have the wailing of the shepherds. There's a sound of the shepherds wail, for their glory is ruined. Well, literal shepherds didn't have any glory. They were very low in their social position in that culture. So this is a reference to the Jewish leaders. The political leadership is in mourning. Why? Because Jerusalem and the temple has been destroyed. That causes the wailing. Then he speaks of the Jordan Valley in verse 3. There's a sound of the young lion's roar, for the pride of the Jordan is ruined. Now, while the Romans did devastate some areas, they did not follow a scorched earth policy. Okay. Now, a little literal interpretation requires that during the first Jewish revolt. But that did not happen during the first Jewish revolt. That happened during the second Jewish revolt. So again, this would be a reference to the royal princes. And the Jordan Valley, of course, was frequented by lions. So anyway, this is probably a reference to the royal princes. Now, again, the Romans did demonstrate some areas of this of the Jordan Valley. Here's the Jordan River Valley, right here, from the Sea of Galilee down to the bottom of the Dead Sea. Now, in close, we see that Qumran is in the northern end. That was devastated. And here's the ruins of Qumran. You can visit them today. You can see the Dead Sea off in the distance, in the background there. And these are the famous Qumran caves, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. So Qumran was devastated, yes. And Masada was devastated. And of course, here's a picture of Masada. But the Romans did not follow a scorched earth policy. And so this was all fulfilled in 70 AD. It was a limited devastation of Judah with a focus on the temple. That's what's going to happen in verses 1 through 3. There's going to be a limited devastation of Judah. The focus will be on the temple. Now, two reasons for this devastation are now revealed. The first reason for the devastation is the rejection of the true shepherd in verses 4 through 14. This is a very, very important messianic prophecy. In fact, the rabbis struggle with this prophecy. And the missing link, of course, is Yeshua. But here are some Chino books of the Bible. Here's a standard Jewish commentary that says, this prophecy, observes Driver, is the most enigmatic in the Hebrew Bible. Most puzzling, he says. Many attempts have been made to find a period in history, the events of which would explain the allusion it contains. Suggestions ranging from pre-exilic days down to the Roman period have been put forward, but the theories are far from convincing. Among the Jewish commentators, Rashi interprets the prophecy as a picture of God's relations with Israel in the past, through the time of the Jewish monarchy until the Babylonian captivity. That's Rashi's opinion. Ibn Ezra refers it to the period following the Maccabean Wars, while Kimke regards the prophecy as messianic. So the rabbis are confused about this prophecy, but the missing link is Yeshua. Once you get him in there, it all falls into place. So we have the commission of the prophet in verses 4 through 6. So the process of fulfilling verses 1 through 3, the devastation of the land, begins. We start with a reference to the flock in verse 4. Thus says the Lord my God, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. So thus says the Lord my God. Zechariah's God tells him to play the role of a shepherd. The flock of slaughter is Israel. They are destined for destruction. And this is in keeping with verses 1 through 3. And they were destroyed by Rome in A.D. 70. And we see that also prophesied in Daniel 9:26. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people, the prince who is to come, will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And its end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. Now this is a key messianic prophecy to use, especially to use when witnessing to your Jewish friend. Notice Daniel 9:26 tells us the Messiah had to come and suffer before 70 AD. Okay, Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And then the city and the sanctuary, there's the focus on the temple, will be destroyed. So Messiah had to come before AD 70. The condition of the flock is then described in verses 5 and 6. First of all, it's abandoned by man. Those who buy them, slay them and go unpunished. And each of those who sell them says, blessed be the Lord, for I become rich. And their own shepherds have no pity on them. So those who buy them and slay them are the Romans. They're Gentiles. And they don't hold themselves guilty. They think it's fine to kill the enemy. The shepherds would be the Jewish leaders. And they say, blessed be the Lord, I'm rich. You know, they abandon the flock in order to become rich. And it's well known that the Sadducean priests had plenty of wealth and were greedy. And so their own shepherds pity them not. And we see that in John 11:47 and 48 as well. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, what are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. You know, he just raised Lazarus from the dead. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him. They didn't want people to believe in him. You know, they didn't care about the raising a Jewish man from the dead. All men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. See, there's their concern. Their concern is their power and prestige. They aren't overwhelmed by the fact that Jesus just raised Lazarus from the dead, and that he would be of great physical and spiritual benefit to the country. They're worried about their place and their nation being taken from them by the Romans. So they've abandoned the flock as well. So the flock's abandoned by man, but in verse 6, it's also abandoned by God. For I will no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land, declares the Lord. But behold, I will cause the men to fall, each into another's power and into the power of his king. And they will strike the land, and I will not deliver them from their power. So I will no more have pity on the inhabitants of the land. This is the same idea we ran across in Hosea. Remember way, way back in Hosea, Hosea chapter 1, verse 6? Then she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter, and the Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel, that I would ever forgive them. And then we drop down to verses 8 and 9. When she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son, and the Lord said, named him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, I am not your God. Abandoned by God. Same idea. And he's going to deliver every man into the hand of his neighbor. And this is a reference to the civil strife that occurred in the city in 70 AD. And this civil war inside the city led to the fall of the temple and Jerusalem. Zealots against zealots. It was pretty gruesome. It wasn't the power of Rome that destroyed the temple and Jerusalem. It was this civil war inside the city. So he's going to deliver the people into the hand of his king. That'd be a reference to Caesar. And that's what we said in John 19:15. We said when we rejected Jesus, we said we have no king but Caesar. Well, to Caesar you will go. And the land will be smitten as verses 1 through 3 has implied and predicted. And there'll be no deliverance. I will not deliver them. And Josephus tells us how many Jewish people were killed and captured during the 70 AD war. Josephus in the Wars of the Jews, 693, states, "Now the number of those that were carried captive during the whole war was collected to be 97,000 going to slavery. 97,000 Jewish men, women, and children went into slavery. As the number of those that perished during the whole siege, 1,100,000. 1,100,000 were killed. 1,100,000 were killed. 97,000 taken into slavery by Josephus' reckoning." Now, as we come to verse 7 through 11, we come to the carrying out of the commission. The feeding of the flock of slaughter begins in verse 7. "So I pastured the flock doomed to slaughter, hence the afflicted of the flock. And I took for myself two staffs, the one I called favor, the other I called union. And so I pastured the flock." So the flock is all Israel. And the offer of salvation was to the whole flock. But the emphasis is on the poor of the flock. And those who accepted Yeshua as Messiah are the poor of the flock. Now let's see how Yeshua fulfilled that commission. Literally, Matthew 9, 35 and 36. Jesus was going through all the cities and villages. See, the ministry was to the entire nation, all their cities, all their villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Notice his emphasis, though. "Seeing the people, he felt compassion on them because they were distressed and dispirited like sheep without a shepherd." So while the ministry of teaching was to the entire nation, the emphasis was on those distressed and dispirited. So he took two staves. You know, two staves are standard equipment for a shepherd. One's called beauty. Noam is the Hebrew. It can also be translated graciousness or something like that. Now, this would be a short, thick club used for protection. You know, the shepherd gets this short, thick club to bash a lion over the head with it. And the Messiah wanted to protect Israel. Remember, he said, like a hen protects her chicks under her wings. That's the way he wanted to do it, he said. So he wanted to protect the nation. The other staff is called bands, chovlim. It can also be translated binding. And Yeshua wanted to promote unity in the flock. So this staff was used to keep the flock together. Messiah wanted to unify the nation. And then he says, "I fed the flock." The flock was fed. Yeshua taught clear prepositional truth during the first half of his ministry. And so this commission was fulfilled. He taught clearly the first half of his ministry. But conflict developed. And he destroyed three other shepherds. Verse 8. "Then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month, for my soul was impatient with them, and they're so also weary of me." Now, this is probably three segments of the Jewish leadership. And there's four possibilities. This phrase has generated more than 40 positions, but I think only the fourth one really is the best. One position is the priests, the scribes, and the elders, as the four shepherds, four leaders, and those who pastured the flock. And then the civil authority and religious authority and false prophets, some suggest. And others suggest lawyers, Pharisees, and Sadducees, or scribes, Pharisees, and Sadducees. So that's probably the best so far. But the scribes were part of the Pharisees. The lawyers were part of the Pharisees. So I think that's doubling up something there that shouldn't be doubled up. And I think there's a better option. And the option that I would suggest would be Herodians, Pharisees, and Sadducees. Now, why do I suggest that? Well, because of the conflict that developed during Yeshua's last week in Jerusalem. Matthew 22, 15 through 16, we learn that the Pharisees went and plotted together how they might trap him in what he said. So we have the Pharisees at odds with him, in conflict with him. And what did they do? And they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. So the Herodians were part of this plot to trap Jesus, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are truthful and teach the way of God in truth and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any." So we have Pharisees and Herodians, both leadership groups, attacking Yeshua. And then in verse 23 of chapter 22, "On that day some Sadducees, who say there's no resurrection, came to Jesus and questioned him." So we have the Sadducees attacking him too. So I think that's the best position. based on the scripture. Herodians, Pharisees, and Sadducees are the three shepherds that Yeshua defeated when they attacked his theology. And there was mutual antagonism between the two groups. Yeshua's soul was weary of them, and their soul loathed me. And we see this in Matthew chapter 21 and chapter 23. And the word loathed here means to be nauseated, to abhor, to despise, as Isaiah 53:3 says. So the leadership were disgusted with Yeshua. They wanted nothing to do with him. They wanted him dead. But he defeated them in the temple with their questioning and proved himself to be the sinless, spotless Lamb of God. So the shepherds would be destroyed and the feeding would cease in verse 9. Then I said, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. What is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. And let those who are left eat one another's flesh. All right, so there's a rupture between the good shepherd and the people as a whole. And Yeshua then prioritized spiritual relationships over physical relationships. And we see that prioritization occur in Mark 3:21 and then 31 through 35 in verse 21. When his own people heard of this, they went out to take custody of him, for they were saying he's lost his senses. His own people is his family. You know, Yeshua's gone crazy. He's wacko. Okay? Then we drop down to verse 31 to 35. Then his mother and his brothers arrived. So here's his own family thinking he's crazy. And standing outside, they sent word to him and called him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, behold, your mothers and your brothers are outside looking for you. So Yeshua doesn't break up the lesson and go out to them. He says, who are my mother and my brothers? And looking about at those who were sitting around him, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. So Yeshua has prioritized spiritual relationships over physical relationships. And he ended the feeding in order to leave them to the natural course of events. You know, in the Gospels, Yeshua stopped teaching clear propositional truth and started teaching parables. And we see that in Matthew 13, verses 10 through 13. After the rejection of his messiahship in Matthew 12, we read, the disciples came and said to him, why do you speak to them in parables? And Jesus answered them, to you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been granted. For whoever has, to him more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has shall be taken away from him. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because while seeing they do not see, while hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. So the responsibility is placed right upon the student. Okay? So he has now stopped teaching clear propositional truth. He's teaching in parables. And the natural course of events, that which dies, let it die. That which is going to be cut off, let it be cut off. And let them that are left eat the flesh of one another. Ooh, that's gruesome. But this is one of the curses of the Mosaic Law, the curse of cannibalism. When Israel entered into the Mosaic Law, if we obey, he would bless us. But if we disobey, he would discipline us, and that discipline will get harder and harder and harder if we continue to ignore it and continue to disobey. And one of the very worst aspects of that discipline is the curse of cannibalism. Leviticus 26:29, toward the end of the cursing section. Further, you shall eat the flesh of your sons and the flesh of your daughters you will eat. There it is, the curse of cannibalism, repeated in Deuteronomy 28, verses 53 through 57. One of the more gruesome and severe curses of the covenant. And it was experienced on a number of times in Israel during the siege of Samaria, 2 Kings 6, 24 through 29. During the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem, Jeremiah 19:9, Ezekiel 5:10. That was in 586 BC. And then during the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, Josephus records now of those that perished by famine in the city, the number was prodigious, and the miseries they underwent unspeakable. That's part of that civil war that was happening in the city. Now there was a certain woman, the famine pierced through her very bowels and marrow, and then attempted a most unnatural thing. Snatching up her child, she slew her son and roasted him and ate the one half of him. So Josephus had access to this gruesome news article. This woman suffered the curse of cannibalism. Israel was suffering the curse of cannibalism during the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. In verse 10, the breaking of the staff favor or beauty is described. I took my staff favor and cut it in pieces to break my covenant, which I had made with all the peoples. Now, this covenant would be an indirect and informal covenant with the Gentiles that is broken. Now, a better rendering of that word would be annulled or invalidated. God has an indirect and informal covenant with the Gentiles to let them go only so far in disciplining Israel. But now that covenant is invalidated, annulled, and they are allowed to destroy and really hurt the nation. Now, why would I say this is an indirect and informal covenant with Gentiles? Well, first of all, because God is not a covenant breaker. He will not break any of his covenants with Israel. Deuteronomy 7:9. Know therefore that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God, who keeps his covenant and his loving kindness to 1,000 generations, to those who love him and keep his commandments. So God is not a covenant breaker. So this covenant must be informal and indirect. It's not a formal covenant. And we see this acted out in Luke 19, verses 41 through 44. And by the way, the language of verse 10 refers to Gentiles. Kol ha'amin, the peoples, the peoples. So we have an indirect, informal covenant with Gentiles. God is not a covenant breaker. This is an informal agreement that he invalidates with the Gentiles, because that's the language of the text. All right, and now we see the grief that it brought upon Yeshua to give the Gentiles permission to destroy the city and the sanctuary. When he approached Jerusalem, he saw the city and wept over it. Notice the grief there, saying, if you had known in this day, even you, the things which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side. And they will level you to the ground and your children within you. And they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. And then in Luke 21:24, and they will fall by the edge of the sword, and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So the Gentiles are allowed to destroy the city and the sanctuary. And this breaking of favor or beauty was fulfilled at the time. The break happened in chapter 12, verses 22 through 45, with the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus. That's when the breaking of favor or beauty occurred. Matthew 12:22 through 45. Then there's an effect on the poor of the flock in verse 11. So it was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized it was the word of the Lord. Again, it was annulled or invalidated. God's limitation on the Gentiles was taken away, and the faithful remnant of the first century understood what was going on. And this was all they fulfilled. They obeyed this admonition from the Lord by their flight to Pella in AD 70. They obeyed the prophecy of Luke 21:20-21. And this is a very, very critical event in Jewish history and Messianic Jewish history. The first Jewish revolt against Rome, a very critical event. So let's talk about it just a little bit. Now, the first Jewish revolt against Rome was triggered by a Roman attack on the Jewish citizens of Caesarea or Caesarea. The Jewish community retaliated by slaughtering the Roman garrison in Jerusalem. Now, when the revolt broke out in the year 66 AD, the Messianic Jews were caught in a dilemma. The dilemma, should we fight or not fight? The reason for the dilemma is this prophecy, Luke 21:21-24. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city, Jerusalem, must leave, and those who are in the country must not enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Okay, as a result of the rejection of the Messiahship of Yeshua, Jerusalem is destined for destruction. And the sign, the Messianic Jews, to the Messianic Jews, that this destruction was about to come to pass, is when they see armies surrounding Jerusalem. Now at that time, they would know that her destruction is at hand. Now if they're in the city, get out. If they're outside the city, don't go in. And no matter who you are, outside the city or inside the city, get out and leave the country. Now because of this particular prophecy, the Messianic Jews felt they could not take arms to defend the city and defend the country. Their spiritual priorities superseded their physical priorities. They had to obey Yeshua first and not join the army. Now when the revolt broke out, the Roman general Sestus Gallus was headquartered at Caesarea, and he came with his armies and surrounded the city. That surrounding of the city was a sign that the Messianic Jews took as the fulfillment of the Luke account, Luke 21. The problem, of course, was how do you leave a city? How do you leave a city that's surrounded? Well, Sestus Gallus had advanced too quickly, and he hadn't secured his supply lines properly. Soon, Jewish guerrilla forces began cutting his supply lines along the route between Caesarea and Jerusalem. So finally, he chose to lift the siege and head back and secure his position first. On the way back to Caesarea, he was attacked and killed. So, as a result, for a period of about 2 years, the siege of Jerusalem was lifted. And when the armies left, the Messianic Jews took off to the east. Here's a map of the area. This is Jerusalem here in Judea. And up north, just south of the Sea of Galilee, is the town of Pella. So the Jewish Christians, Messianic Jews, left Jerusalem. They went east over the Jordan River, up the Jordan River Valley to this town of Pella. And they waited out the war in Pella. Now in 68 AD, the Romans again laid siege to the city, this time under Vespasian and then under Titus. And in 70 AD, the city was destroyed. Now we have a parallel report on this by a church historian of about the 3rd century, Eusebius. I'm going to be quoting from his book, Ecclesiastical History. Eusebius Pamphilus, Ecclesiastical History. The Christians of the Jerusalem community, through a prediction, revealed to multiple people of this church, had received a warning to emigrate from there and go before the outbreak of the war and go to a region in the Jordan called Pella. And in fact, leaving Jerusalem, they took refuge in the place indicated. So the regal capital of Judea and the whole region was what? Left without the saints. 100%, they all left. He goes on quoting an earlier writer of Jewish history, a Jewish Christian named Hegesippus. He goes on to point out that not one single Jewish Christian lost his life in this revolt because they in total left the country as well as the city. There wasn't a single Jewish Christian left in Judea or Jerusalem in 70 AD, when the city was destroyed. And remember, Josephus tells us in his writings that a total of 1,100,000 Jews were killed during the First Roman War, but Eusebius tells us that not a single Jewish Christian was among the number. And all this occurred because the staff favor or beauty was broken. Now we come in verses 12 through 14 to a discussion of the price of the Good Shepherd. Verse 12 gives us the attitude of the Jewish leaders. I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages, but if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. So give me my hire as the Good Shepherd. And he was worth 30 pieces of silver. Now, that might sound pretty good, but that's the price of contempt, because that was the price of a dead slave. In Exodus 21:32, if your ox killed your neighbor's slave, you had to compensate your neighbor for the loss of a slave, the dead slave. If the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. And so the dead slave was worth 30 pieces of silver. A free man, now notice this, a free man or a healthy slave was worth twice that amount, 60 shekels of silver. So this is a price of contempt. In the beginning of verse 13, Zechariah is given a commission. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. He's told to cast the money to the potter's area of the temple complex. The potter was one of the lowest of the neighboring laboring classes. And in strong sarcasm, he says, the goodly price that I was prized by them. You know, and I was prized. That's God himself. That's not Zechariah who's being prized here. This is God himself. This is a price for God, a sign of contempt. And again, it's a sarcasm. The goodly price, the splendid value, the magnificent price that they valued God. And the fulfillment is in Matthew 26, 14 through 16, where Judas receives 30 pieces of silver to betray Yeshua. Then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what are you willing to give me to betray him to you? And they weighed out 30 pieces of silver. He's only worth a minimum amount. From then on, he began looking for a good opportunity to betray Jesus. Well, Judas was probably hoping for more, but he loved money so much he'd take whatever he could, even the price of contempt, to betray Yeshua. Now the commission is carried out in the second part of the verse. And I took the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. So Zechariah now portrays the actions of Judas. He's in the temple, casting them to the potter. And this is fulfilled literally in Matthew 27, 3 through 10. Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 purses of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. But they said, what is that to us? See that yourself. They're not concerned that a betrayal has occurred. They're not concerned that the person betrayed is innocent. They're just as guilty of betraying Jesus as well. They just want Jesus dead. So this is a personal problem. Don't bother us with it. And so Judas threw the pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary and departed. And he went away and hanged himself. Then the chief priest took the pieces of silver and said, very hypocritically, it's not lawful to put them into the temple treasury, since it's the price of blood, their own price for Yeshua's blood. And they conferred together with the money and bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. So there they massage their consciences. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then what was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me. And so we see the fulfillment in Matthew 27, 3 through 10. Now, did you note that he says Jeremiah, fulfilled by Jeremiah? And we're quoting from Zechariah. Well, Matthew is not mistaken here. Matthew is doing pearl stringing here. Pearl stringing is taking verses and considering them like pearls on a pearl necklace and putting them together one after another. And that's what he's doing. He's stringing verses together here from Zechariah and Jeremiah. It was a typical technique of the period, and we do it as well. And so he just mentions Jeremiah. He doesn't mention Zechariah there. So he's not in error. Now we come to verse 14 and the breaking of bands, a union. Then I cut in pieces my second staff union to break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. So the unity of the Jews is destroyed. Factions formed within the city of Jerusalem. They fought against each other viciously inside of besieged Jerusalem. They even burned some of the foodstuffs that were in there. And this civil war inside the city caused Jerusalem to fall to Rome. And as a result, the Jews are scattered. Zechariah 13 will bring this out again, and the Jews are scattered. So let's summarize Zechariah 11, 1 through 14. First of all, before the destruction, Messiah will come. Before 70 AD, Messiah has to come. Secondly, only a remnant will follow him. The majority will not. The majority will value him equal to that of a dead slave. They will hold him in contempt. And the consequence, the people will be given over to the Gentiles and scattered. And Messiah is the good shepherd here. Zechariah was portraying the career of Yeshua himself. And remember, Yeshua says he's the good shepherd in John 10, verses 11 through 18. Now we come to a sequel, describing the foolish shepherd in verses 15 through 17. This is the second reason for the destruction prophesied in verses 1 through 3, the acceptance of the false shepherd. And so the process of fulfilling verses 1 through 3 comes to a completion. So we were at the first coming in verses 1 through 14. Now we jump to a unique time frame I call the first worldwide dispersion in verses 15 through 17. This doesn't show up very much, but it does show up here in Zechariah. So there's a new commission given to the prophet in verse 15. The Lord said to me, take again for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. So he has to play a second role. Take again the equipment of a foolish shepherd. So he's going to play the part of the foolish shepherd. Now, foolish doesn't mean the guy is a nitwit. What it means is that he's morally deficient or corrupt. A fool in Hebrew is a person who's morally deficient and corrupt. And he takes the instruments, the two staffs, and they are the same, but they have different uses. The good shepherd uses them properly. The foolish shepherd uses them improperly. Now, the reason and purpose for this commission is brought out in verse 16. For behold, I am going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for the perishing. He will not seek the scattered. He will not heal the broken. He will not sustain the one standing, but will devour the flesh of the fat sheep and tear off their hooves. So this shepherd is going to be the very opposite of Yeshua. He'll not do what a shepherd should do. Visit, seek, heal, feed. Rather, he will destroy the flock. He will be cruel and brutal. So a foolish shepherd will arise and be accepted, but will not do these things that the good shepherd did. And that foolish shepherd who arose and who was accepted was Simon bar Kochba, who led the second Jewish revolt from 132 to 135. Now, some feel that the foolish shepherd is a reference to the Antichrist. I feel that Bar Kochba is a much better alternative that fits the context better. So the foolish shepherd is a reference to the second Jewish revolt or the Bar Kochba revolt. Now, the cause of the revolt was Hadrian the Emperor's announcement that he was going to rebuild Jerusalem and rename it Aelia Capitolina and turn it into a Gentile town. You know, Jerusalem had been pretty much destroyed in 70 AD. This is another 70 years had passed, and he wanted to kind of fix up the ruins that were, you know, that were still laying there. Now, the Jewish people were not impressed with the city development plans, and they revolted. Now, some scholars think that up to 30% of the Jewish community were believers in Yeshua at this time. So initially, the Messianic Jews joined the revolt because the prohibition that kept them out of the first Jewish revolt was no longer valid. The warning of Luke 21 was a thing of the past. The leader of this revolt was a man named Simon bar Kochba, and he was initially very successful in defeating the Romans. Halfway through the revolt, however, Rabbi Akiva, the leading Torah rabbi of the day, declared Simon bar Kochba to be the Messiah. He renamed him Simon bar Kochba, which means Simon, son of the star. The name is based on a Numbers passage in which Messiah is associated with the star, Numbers 24:17. Once he did that, the nature of the revolt totally changed. It was no longer a merely a nationalistic fight. It was also a religious battle under the messianic banner of Bar Kochba. And remember, spiritual relationships supersede physical relationships. And because of this change, the messianic Jews, the Jewish Christians, withdrew from the army. And their absence weakened the army significantly. Now, if 30% is an accurate figure, a 30% loss in soldiers would definitely weaken the army considerably. Now, the Messianic Jews were heavily criticized for this move. The term Meshumadim, destroyer, was applied to the believers. So they left the revolt, leaving it to its destruction. The Romans eventually crushed the rebellion. In the year 135, Bar Kochba was isolated in the city of Beitar, and Beitar becomes Bar Kochba's last stand. He is killed at Beitar. Now, in response to this defeat, the Jewish people renamed Bar Kochba Bar Kochba. Okay, here's the names of Bar Kochba. He started out as Bar Kochba. That's his original name. The name his mama gave him, his dad gave him, Bar Kochba. But Rabbi Akiva named him Bar Kochba, son of a star. Reference to the Messianic prophecy, Numbers 24:17. That's Rabbi Akiva's name for him. But after everything failed, the populace renamed him Bar Kochba, son of Alar. Bar Kochba, Bar Kochba, Bar Kochba, his final name. So you see the word plays going on there. So now we come to the judgment of the foolish shepherd in verse 17. Woe to the worthless shepherd who leaves the flock. A sword will be on his arm and on his right eye. His arm will be totally withered, and his right eye will be blind. So his arm is going to be dried up. You know, his arm should have been used to protect the flock. This corresponds to beauty or to favor. His eye should have been used to watch the flock so it doesn't scatter and be destroyed. This corresponds to bands or unity. But Bar Kokhba was not a good shepherd. And with the failure of the Bar Kokhba revolt, the destruction of the land began its final phase. The Romans followed a scorched earth policy this time, and the land sunk into a wasteland. And in addition, the land was renamed Palestine. Hadrian renamed the land Palestine, land of the Philistines. That's where the name comes from, you guys. 135 AD. That's where the name came from, and it's stuck even till today. It was an insult, a name he deliberately chose to insult the Jews and try to eradicate their presence from the promised land. And that's still going on today. Jerusalem became off limits to all Jews. Jerusalem was renamed Aelia Capitolina and was made into a Gentile city. And Israel, the Jewish people, were taken into the diaspora, and only an extremely tiny remnant remained in the land. So the diaspora process, which began in 70 AD, is now completed in 135 AD. That's the date. 135 is when the land was renamed Palestine, land of the Philistines. Now remember, the foolish shepherd is not Antichrist. Why? Because Antichrist will be of Roman background, not Jewish background. Daniel 9, 26 and 27. Then after 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. That's 30 AD. Then the Roman army will arrive in 70 AD. Messiah has to come before the Roman army destroys the city and the sanctuary. So the Roman army arrives, and the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. That's 70 AD. The Antichrist is the prince who is to come. He's not on the scene yet. He's future. But his people are on the scene in 70 AD. And so, speaking of the city and the sanctuary, its end will come with a flood, a military invasion. Even to the end, there will be war, and desolations are determined. That's the first Jewish revolt in 70 AD. And so the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. But the prince who is to come is Antichrist. And now, in verse 27, the reference is to Antichrist. And he, the prince who is to come, will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week. Now, Vespasian and Titus did not make any kind of a covenant with the Jewish people. And in the middle of the week, a covenant which he breaks, by the way, but in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. But the Antichrist will make a seven-year covenant with the Jewish people, and at the three-and-a-half-year point, he will desecrate the temple and stop the sacrificial system. And on a wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate. The temple will be desecrated, even until a complete destruction, that is, decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate, and the Antichrist will be annihilated eventually. So remember, the Antichrist is not Jewish. He is of Roman origin. All right, this brings us to our next Zechariah theme and application chart. And the scripture we're looking at is Zechariah 9:11 through 11:17. The theme I chose was Messiah. He is our cornerstone, tent peg, and battle bow. And what did we see in the biblical text? We saw that when the Lord returns to Israel, the Messiah of the tribe of Judah will be Israel's cornerstone. He'll be the foundation of their salvation. Two, he'll be Israel's tent peg. Everything they consider important will hang on him. And three, he will be Israel's battle bow. With him resides the power to defeat their enemies. So what about us? Can Jesus relate to us on this level too? Yes, he can. We need to ask ourselves some questions. Is Yeshua your cornerstone, my cornerstone, our cornerstone? Is he the single most important item in our spiritual salvation? Acts 4, 10 through 12. Ephesians 2, 19 through 22. 1 Peter 2, 4 through 6. Is he our cornerstone? Secondly, is Yeshua our tent peg? Do you have everything that is meaningful to you hanging on him? First of all, your sorrows. 1 Peter 5, 6 and 7. He can take our sorrows. Do you let him bear your concerns? Do you hang your joys on him, your talents, your possessions, your affections, your loves? All your best belongs to Yeshua, who purchased us with his own blood, Colossians 3, 1 and 2, Matthew 6, 19 through 20, and verse 24. Everything belongs to Yeshua. Is Yeshua your battle bow? You know, we're involved in a spiritual war. We believers have three main enemies, the world, the flesh, and the devil. And they attack us and tempt us to sin in three areas, our body, our soul, and our spirit. We're involved in a spiritual war. As Rabbi Paul said, Ephesians 6:2, also mentioned by James in James 4:7, turn to Yeshua and his word for the weapons to defeat our spiritual enemies. Yeshua has to be our battle bow. He needs to be our cornerstone, our tent peg, and our battle bow. We need to trust him and look to him for everything. All right, I see that our time is just about up, and now we've come to chapter 12, the second burden of the word of the Lord, and I think this is a good time to stop, and we'll pick it up next session with chapter 12 and the second burden of the word of the Lord. So thanks for being our students at this session. We look forward to the class to come in Zechariah chapter 12. Lehitra'ot.